Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. And as this year comes to a close, we are looking back on some of the stories that dominated the news in 2013. Today, we will focus on the rise and fall of the Tea Party in 2013 and begin with a broadcast of Background Briefing for May 16, 2013, when the Tea Party was claiming political victimhood. We analyze the real nature of the Tea Party movement with Chris Parker, the author of a new book, Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We discuss his thoroughly researched study of the Tea Party that presents itself as a new revolutionary phenomenon when in fact it is the old reactionary right repackaged as a grassroots movement. With its funding from billionaires, it is much more the heir of the Know-Nothing Party, the Ku Klux Klan, and the John Birch Society than to those who inspired the American Revolution. Then from October the 2nd, 2013, we speak with two Washington insiders who wrote the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann were among the first to expose the capture of the Republican Party by extremists, and we discuss the threat to the Constitution posed by the Tea Party radicals who want nothing short of an unconditional surrender by Barack Obama of his presidency. Then finally, from October the 8th, 2013, we look into arguments before the Supreme Court in McCutcheon versus the FEC that could strike down any remaining limits on spending on candidates and parties. Senator Bernie Sanders, who was in the Supreme Court and later spoke on the steps afterwards, joins us to discuss whether the court will further empower a few billionaires like those behind the Tea Party shutdown who are radically altering the American political landscape, moving the country further and further to the right. And joining us now is Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington and the author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book just out is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Parker.
Thank you, Ian. I'm honored to be here.
And clearly the IRS is on the defensive, and so is the White House, by the way, today in the press conference with the Turkish Prime Minister. The President once again went after the IRS and said how terrible it is, and we have to be completely nonpartisan at the IRS. And, of course, the acting head has been fired or is obviously stepped down under fire. It's a bit hard to understand why the President is being so defensive at this point when, in fact, he could turn the whole thing around by pointing out that the IRS, in fact, hasn't done its job. It wasn't that they were doing too much, they were doing too little. These 501c4s have opened the floodgates for anonymous billionaires to pour millions and billions into our elections. And the IRS, basically, 90% of the applications have come from right-wing groups. So, you know, obviously they should have gone after Karl Rove, but I don't see the problem. Do you?
No, well, there is a slight problem in that, yes. I mean, it should be, the IRS should be, you know, politics-free. However, and it's a big however, the IRS went after the NAACP in 2004 because Julian Bond, the chairman at the time, he's now chairman emeritus, you know, spoke out against Bush policies, the war, the economy, and, you know, so on and so forth, right? So, you know, most people get audited, you know, after the IRS receives their taxes, but they got audited in October, which is an odd time. So so there's one example. Let me just call forth a couple other figures I think the listeners may be interested in. The first of which is there are about 296 potential political cases the IRS ended up with. That is to say, cases from the far right. Do you know how many were denied? I'm just going to ask you just a guess. I'll give you one educated guess. How many were denied?
Probably two.
No. Zero.
There you go.
Zero.
Right.
Were denied, right? So there are 108 approved, 28 cases in which the application was withdrawn by the applicant, and there are 160 cases that are now pending. Now, I will hazard a guess that those will go through scot-free, given the current political climate.
And your book, Chris Parker, Change They Can't Believe In, the brand new book that's just out here with co-author Matt Barreto, I guess makes the case that the Tea Party is not a revolutionary party, as it's been largely portrayed as in a benign way by both the left and the right-wing press, I would argue, going back to the idea that their roots come out of the outrage over the bailout on Wall Street, which for reasons that still mystify me, the political left in this country did not seize upon. But that's another argument. But I'm saying that what I get out of your new book is that the Tea Party is not a revolutionary party. It's a reactionary party.
Yes, that is very much so the case. So first of all, you know, some people want to make this argument, and I run into them all the time. Oh, yeah, the Tea Party, you know, they hated Bush, too. It's like the Tea Party did not exist on Bush's watch, right? It did not exist at all. Okay, let me just give you a few facts and figures about Bush, right? When we start talking about the deficit, for example, it expanded more than any other time in history. Oh, and we just found out this morning that the deficit has decreased. So projected decrease by $200 billion, right? We found that out this morning, right? So let me throw that on the table. Moreover, the increase in discretionary spending increased by a total of 49% on Bush's watch. Even if you compare Bush to Clinton, right, and looking at the federal government, on Clinton's watch, the federal government increased by 11%. On Bush's watch, it increased by 104%. Bush entered office with a $700 billion surplus, thanks to Clinton. He departed with a $1.3 billion deficit, which constitutes a $2 billion swing. TARP was initiated on Bush's watch, $700 billion bailout to GM, AIG, and Citigroup. So if conservatives were so upset, and the Tea Party claimed that they're really all about fiscal matters and small government, I ask you, where were they on Bush's watch?
Well, that's the point, though, isn't it? That, again, the point that you make in your new book, Change They Can't Believe In, Christopher Parker, co-authored with Matt Barreto, is that the Tea Party is just a repackaging of the far right in this country. You go back to the Know-Nothings, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s, and, as you just mentioned, the John Birch Society. I think that's a part of the brilliance of the Kochs and others, is that they've managed to make this look like it is something new when it is, in fact, something old and perpetually noxious.
Yeah, this sort of reactionary conservatism has been around for a very long time, as you mentioned. We tie it to the Know-Nothing Party of the 1850s, to the Klan of the 1920s, to the John Birch Society, and obviously to the Tea Party now. And what they all have in common is their definition of what a quote-unquote real American is, generally white, male, middle class and wealthier, older, Protestant, heterosexual. This is who the and it's riven, the social science literature is riven with this description, right? Both empirically and sort of thematically, right? That is who the real American is. And every time there's a threat, a possible sustained threat to this, you get one of these far-right reactionary movements that comes around because it's a reaction to what they perceive as rapid social change and that their America is being stolen from them, pilfered from them.
Well, but it seems to me, and I think in many ways Ronald Reagan, you know, and he's the darling of every conservative in this country, he appealed to that atavistic Ozzie and Harriet, June Cleaver era of black and white television that was really unreal to begin with. The only reason that we had white America then living this perfect American dream was that blacks and Hispanics were invisible. They were there, but they weren't shown. And what's happened since is that the rest of America, the other real Americans, they've gradually stepped out of the shadows. And is that what they can't deal with?
Yeah, it's that, but it's what Obama represents, right? Think about who the president is, you know, in American political life. We know, research has shown, we know who the president is from the time we're a little kid. The president is an authority figure in our lives from the time we're little kids, right? He is not only the head of government, but the face of America, you know, beyond our shores, internationally. And so for a lot of people, for most of us, especially as we move into adulthood, our identity becomes connected to the presidency, because the presidency represents us all, right? So what happens then if you have someone in that position who no longer looks like you, right? It makes you paranoid. It makes you a little nervous that the commander-in-chief of the military is no longer a white man, right? The chief law enforcement officer is no longer a white man, right? The face of America is no longer a white man, right? That is a powerful symbol to these folks.
But what explains, though, Chris Parker, what explains why conservative America is happy with Condoleezza Rice, with Colin Powell, and they've got this surgeon, I can't remember his name now, this is a new champion of
Ben Carson.
There you go, yeah. So these people, and you got Clarence Thomas, for God's sake, on the Supreme Court. So,
yeah, but I don't think they people really consider him to be black. But anyway, that's a different case.
Right, but if you could give me some insight into why it is that Obama scares the hell out of them and Ben Carson is a hero.
Okay, so let me clarify this. Let's make a distinction between more mainstream moderate conservatives and reactionary conservatives, right? Mm-hmm. So one distinction is that more moderate mainstream conservatives, when you think about these people, if you think about them like back in the 60s when we really started having, when we had this split in conservatives or in the Republican Party, so you had Rockefeller, you had Mitt Romney's daddy, Nixon on one side, right? And then you had Barry Goldwater on the other side. Right. And so you have these more moderate mainstream conservatives. If we think about what conservatives and Republicans did in the 1960s. Right. You had more Republicans vote for civil rights legislation than you did Democrats. So let's get that out there right now. There are different types of conservatives. Right. So more moderate conservative does not necessarily embrace change, does not necessarily want change, but they'd rather have they'd rather have evolutionary organic change versus revolutionary change, right? I mean, Edmund Burke wrote about this, you know, regarding the French Revolution, right? And then you have, and so they understand change is necessary. When you look at these reactionary conservatives, they don't brook any kind of change whatsoever. They actually want to go back in time. Moderate conservatives, they're okay with moving forward incrementally. These folks, these reactionary conservatives, they want to look back in time. They see social change as subversion of their social prestige. And so we have to go backwards in time. So I just want to get that out of the way. So let me answer your question, though, more directly. So why are they okay with, let's say, Condoleezza Rice?
How about Herman Cain? That's a better example.
Okay. They're more comfortable. You know, this is not going to be the most politically correct answer. Just I want you guys to know that I'm black too, so I think I got a little room to run with here. Herman Cain is one of those quote unquote black folks who says and does all the right things and stays in his place. He's a known quantity, right? He's tied to the United States. Same thing with Colin Powell. One of the reasons why, you know, people are upset with Colin Powell now is that he won't stay in his quote-unquote place. Right? Now he says what he thinks. And so he's sort of alienated from the Republican Party. As a matter of fact, he's on record as saying, I didn't leave the Republican Party. The Republican Party left me.
Sure, and he voted for Obama twice. So.
Yes, and he voted for Obama twice. Condoleezza Rice, I mean, she was on, you know, she was on Bush's, she was in Bush's cabinet. And she did everything that Bush asked him to do. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, I'm saying that these people, if you think about Colin Powell back in the day, if you think about Condoleezza Rice, if you think about Herman Cain, these are quote unquote exceptional black folk and that they are not recognized as being black because they align their political beliefs with the right. Right. At least Colin Powell, not anymore. Right. But they're quote unquote they're OK as far as black folks go. They're the exceptional black folks who don't act like all the rest of the black folks. Now, for Obama, you know, first of all, he has roots in Kenya, right? His father was a Kenyan national, right? And so they see him as a sort of Manchurian candidate. In other words, the reason why they're so scared of Obama, one of the reasons is because they don't really know much about him, number one, right? Number two, they have to gin up this paranoia in order to make this a battle of, as false as it is, between good and evil. They see him and everything he represents as evil. And what I mean, everything he represents, look at what's happened to same-sex rights since he's been in office. They've gotten better. Right. Look at what's happening to immigration reform. He gets in office. I know that was on the table in 2007. It was gone. He gets in office. He makes that a priority now in his second term, because, quite frankly, Obamacare sucked up all the political oxygen when that went through. But now it's a priority. Right. So you look at these groups who would be considered un-American, you know, gays and lesbians, Latinos, right? And it doesn't make a difference if they're natural born or illegal. They're both looked at in the same light, right? These groups' stature has risen collectively, right? But these are putative un-American or non-Americans as far as the phenotype is concerned.
Well,
so that's why we get these differences.
I see. Well, Chris Parker, again, professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington, principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics, and director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington. He's also the author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book, just out, co-written with Matt Barreto, is Change They Can't Believe In, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. And Chris, we're very grateful to be able to offer you a book up here today in support of Background Briefing and of KPFK. And I wanted to talk to you about it because as we started talking about the breaking news or the continuing news about the IRS scandal, again, a somewhat manufactured scandal along with Benghazi and all these other ones, that the press are now saying that Obama's on the ropes, you know, his presidency is over. I mean, this is not Watergate, this is Whitewater, but nevertheless, what about the book in terms of getting this message out? Because this is, as I've said in this interview, what I take away from your book and why I'm grateful for it, Chris, is that, you know, you've taken the mask off this thing. We've dignified this Tea Party movement, and finally somebody's gotten to paint a real portrait of who they are.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity, Ian. Yes, so what we wanted to do, Matt and I, is to take a really precise social scientific measurement of the Tea Party, and that took time. There are several books on the Tea Party that have been published prior to ours, but ours is the first and most meticulous and most social scientific study there is now and that there ever will be. I can guarantee you that. And I say this because we used two surveys, 2010, 2011, that we generated out of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington. Moreover, we conducted a content analysis in which we examined the content and compared the content of the National Review Online, which most people would agree that the National Review is the sort of leading light of, you know, conservative intellectual history, at least since Buckley founded in 1955, I believe. And we compared that content to 42 Tea Party websites in 15 states. And the hypothesis is that if the Tea Party is really just conservative, right, and it's really just conservative and nothing else, then that the content between the National Review Online and the Tea Party websites would be, you know, not necessarily identical, but would be very similar. And that couldn't be further from the truth, right? And so we have a pretty good, and then it's a historical narrative that we tell, linking the current Tea Party, the present day Tea Party, with these right wing reactionary groups, you know, across history in the United States. It's the same basic demographic profile, right? This idea that they feel threatened by some change of some kind. When it came to the Know Nothings, it was about you know, Catholic, you know, Irish Catholic immigrants. When we talk about the 1920s and the Klan, it's about the return of the quote unquote new Negro. It's about, you know, the threat from Jews, a perceived threat from Jews, the perceived threat from Italy and the Pope trying to run American politics, right? And then when we skip ahead to the John Birch Society of the 50s and early 1960s, one that I like to mention that Buckley wrote out of the conservative movement because he even thought they were too far out. They felt threatened by, they thought that, you know, these quote-unquote Eastern elites were in league with communist sympathizers, and that the civil rights movement was a Trojan horse for socialism. And so they went on to claim that Dwight D. Eisenhower, you know, the man that oversaw D-Day, was a communist sympathizer, and they tried to get members of the Supreme Court, including Chief Justice Earl Warren, impeached. So we go a long way. We discuss this because we see a lot of threads that link the Tea Party to these other groups. They're not identical, but they're more similar than they are different by a long shot.
So that leads me to ask you, Chris Parker, since we talked earlier about, at least I mentioned how I find it extraordinary how they get away with the most disgraceful language and attitudes and racism and poisonous rhetoric. And maybe this is a continuum as opposed to a high mark in political depravity.
Well, I mean, we certainly think, mean, yeah, the rhetoric has changed consistent with the changing context, right? But I do want to make it clear, though, that these folks are different from the more moderate mainstream conservatives. I mean, if you heard what even George Bush said the other day, you know, that he said, I disagree with Obama's policies, but I want our president to succeed. He said, I want my president to succeed. Right.
Well, that's true. So, but the famous one, of course, was in the campaign in 2008, where this racist woman said he was a Muslim, and McCain said, no, he's not. He's a decent guy. And
right.
and on any number of occasions, Mitt Romney had the same opportunity with racist comments coming from his audiences against Obama, and Mitt Romney did not step up to the plate and act like a decent human being. I just wanted to mention that because that's on the record.
Right, that is definitely on the record. But the point I wanted to make, the salient point I wanted to make is there is some cleavage between the more mainstream moderate conservatives and the ones that are way out there on the far right, indeed the reactionary conservatives that I'm talking about. So that there are some differences, right? I mean, you're going to get George Will, and you're going to get David Brooks. You're going to get, I would have said Peggy Noonan, but I can't say her. On one side, and you're going to get the Peggy Noonans, you know, on the other side that are closer to the Tea Party. Sam Tannenhaus would be along with the more moderate conservatives, right? So now you got Ted Cruz, you know, that's in Congress right now. That's a senator, first-term senator from Texas, who's really carrying that Tea Party banner. And I think he and Rand Paul, you know, are going to try to out-Tea Party each other all the way through the 2016 electoral cycle. And let me tell you, my friend, that will be must-see TV.
Well, it will be, and that in itself is a problem. It shouldn't be must-see TV, in as much as I don't think people should be allowed to be rabid without being pulled over. Chris Parker, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Parker, who's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics, director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington, and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book, Just Out, co-written with Matt Barreto, is Change They Can't Believe In, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with a broadcast from October the 2nd, 2013, with Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann.
Born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain, as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game.
Bruce Rodner!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J!
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu!
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin!
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an Election Eve analyst for CBS News. He led a working group of scholars and practitioners that helped shape the law known as the McCain-Feingold law that reformed the campaign financing system. He was elected as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2004. And also joining us is Thomas Mann, a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, where he holds the W. Averill Harriman Chair. A noted congressional scholar, he writes and speaks widely on American politics and policymaking, including campaigns, elections, campaign finance reform, and the effectiveness of Congress. Together, they are co-authors of The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track, and most recently, the New York Times bestseller, now out in paperback, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann.
Great to be
here. Delighted to be with you.
And starting with you, Norman, both you and Tom really were ahead of the curve here with your book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, now out in paperback. Did you ever think it could get this worse, though?
You know, Tom and I have thought with the new paperback out, which is an expanded version with an afterword that brings it up to date, that perhaps we should have retitled it, It's Even Worse Than It Was. We don't take much comfort from being ahead of the curve here, Ian. What you might have imagined after President Obama's sweeping reelection and the strong showing of Democrats nationwide in 2012 was that we would get a brief respite from this tribal battling. And instead, we've deteriorated into something that's leading us straight for the abyss.
And Tom, what's your sense of how things have gotten so much worse than it's even worse than it looks?
You know, it reinforces the fact that our problems are deep, that they've been developing over a period of years, that they're rooted in an intense and deep partisan polarization that is not symmetric. One of our parties has really become more extreme, both in its views and agendas, but also importantly in its view of the legitimacy of the opposition party and its belief that it can pursue tactics that the framers of the U.S. Constitution would have been appalled by. It's all good and well to protect minority interests, but the idea that one small group in one house in a bicameral legislature in a separation of powers system can wreak this kind of damage by making non-negotiable demands on a bill that was enacted almost 3 years ago and is now being implemented is just breathtaking.
And Norman Ornstein, you mentioned that after the 2012 elections, you thought that might be a return to civility, if not reality. But in January, shortly after it, the Republicans met at Williamsburg in a retreat to lick their wounds. And apparently they came up with the Williamsburg Accords that essentially have led to this strategy and to this impasse where they've decided that they wouldn't negotiate with the president and they wouldn't negotiate with the Senate and that they'd force them to come to them, both the president and the Senate. And that seems to be how it's played out. So it doesn't seem like they learned their lesson so quickly out of the gate in January.
No, you know, it's funny. And after the election, I joked that since Mitch McConnell had, for the entire Obama first term, said his number one goal was to make Obama a one-term president, that after the 2012 elections, he could say, well, I've achieved the goal of making him a two-term president. Mission accomplished. Now let's govern. But instead, you're exactly right. What happened is a group that had seen its majority in the House shrink, its numbers in the Senate go down, losing handily in a presidential election, which was in many ways a referendum on Obamacare, the Republicans decided that they could keep leverage and maybe even accomplish a good portion of the agenda that they'd run on in 2012 by using these tactics, which are fundamentally blackmail and hostage-taking. And since you're doing it over the basic operations of government, now shut down so that the flu vaccination program at the Centers for Disease Control is stopped as flu season starts. Cancer patients are being blocked from entering trials at NIH. And now we have the full faith and credit of the United States on the line and looming in 2.5 weeks. It's just breathtaking and dismaying.
Again, I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, who writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out. and Thomas Mann, who is a noted congressional scholar, and they are the co-authors of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, just out in paperback. And they were way ahead of the curve when the book originally came out. And interesting enough, you weren't really welcome on all of the Washington talk shows because you committed the heresy of basically blaming one side in this binary press convention of he said, she said. Do you think, Tom, that that press convention is going to continue and essentially assign blame to both sides in this obviously one-sided situation?
Well, we've seen signs of that. A couple of days ago, the Washington Post had this extraordinary editorial about enough of this. The two sides must come together and compromise. And a number of the people critical of false equivalents, including Jim Fallows, you know, took to their blog, cited our own earlier arguments on this. And this morning, the Post attributed the blame to John Boehner, Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan. So there's a hopeful sign. The fact is, Ian, it's very difficult. If you're an academic, if you're a journalist, not with the partisan press, but with the, if you will, mainstream press, and don't want to be charged with partisan bias, you tend to look for tools, techniques that allow you to avoid picking sides, even if the reality you're facing is day and night, up or down, which is he says, she says, they say, but they say something very different. And it's really an admission of weakness, partly professional norms, but even more than that, a difficult environment. And we thought it was important, if you're going to do anything about our dysfunctional politics, you better understand what's wrong. And the biggest unreported story in recent years has been the radicalization of the Republican Party. And until we bring them back into the mainstream, that dysfunction will almost certainly continue.
And Thomas Mann, one of the problems I understand is that the Tea Party congressman, actually I had John Dean on yesterday, who referred to their constituents as low information voters, but they're getting harangued by the Tea Party activists who show up at congressional meetings. That's how it usually is. The activists are the only people that show up when the congressman comes to town, and they're scaring these guys into outright winging any potential Tea Party challenge in a primary. And of course, you've got the Club for Growth and the Koch brothers and others funding these Congress people and effectively creating this environment, at least to my mind, that is pushing this party further and further to the right. But if we are dealing with low information, the mentality of low information voters, what can be done in the next 2.5 weeks to educate these people to the extent that the United States is the gold standard in terms of where you park your money in the world? And if you screw with that, you are doing untold damage to this country.
Your analysis is exactly right. And given the short time frame, it really is only the president who can do that, who can convey to the broader public, and especially those who have this sense of rectitude and mission, that disaster awaits. I think what's most essential is every day, many times, he says, I will not negotiate with the full faith and credit of the United States. It's money spent. We have to pay our bills. If we are the deadbeat nation, we will suffer and the globe will suffer. This is equivalent to arbitrarily shutting the economy down and hurting everyone. He's got to say it clearly, concisely, and repetitively between now and then, and not in any way indicate a willingness to bargain on that. In fact, Ian, I think the real hope coming out of this is that the Republicans have pressed so hard, partly because of the divisions within the party, that there's a chance to go for broke and really try to effectively disarm the debt ceiling forever, either by just abolishing it. It's like an appendix. It serves no useful purpose at all, or by returning to a procedure Mitch McConnell actually built into the last debt ceiling problem, which is giving the president the authority to raise the ceiling himself, then reserving for Congress the right to pass a resolution of disapproval subject to a presidential veto, which in turn requires two-thirds vote in both houses to override it. That's what we need out of this, and if Obama could get that, he could make some compromises on other matters, looking for a fig leaf for the Republicans in all of this, and that would then, I think, be a real triumph. But he can't give on the principle. If he buys a sort of short-term agreement with the debt ceiling and we're back at it in 2 months.
So, Thomas Mann, the president apparently made some of the arguments that we're talking about here on Wednesday evening at the White House when he met with Speaker John Boehner, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Apparently they also got a briefing on the havoc they're going to cause, currently causing by the government shutdown, and the even greater havoc that will be caused by the government defaulting on its debt. So what's your sense then of how these Republican leaders can be educated? Because you see, at least to my mind, in terms of body language, it sure looks like Boehner's caught in a vice and McConnell has certainly behaved more responsibly. So what's your sense of whether these guys are going to change their tune, or are they totally captive by their Tea Party caucus?
If it depends on profiles and courage from Mitch McConnell and John Boehner, the country's in deep trouble. McConnell is facing a Tea Party challenge in the primary for his reelection, as well as a serious Democratic challenger. And John Boehner's speakership, hapless as it is really in a very weak position, and he could lose it all. It really is a matter of sort of generating a sort of sense of really outrage in the broader public now. I'm all for Republican pragmatists forming new super PACs to counter the Club for Growth and Heritage Action and the Koch brothers, if necessary, to try to provide a little protection to those Republicans in the House, and there are some who know their hand is being overplayed and who know just how risky it is. That's why every day's storyline has to be the same. It's very hard to reach people in the public who don't ordinarily pay much attention to politics, and when they do, it's the same old storyline. So it's got to be firm, and it's got to be reinforced by a whole lot of people outside. That's part of what all of our job is.
So, Norm Ornstein, what do you think of Tom's idea that a more traditional Republican, and frankly, they look like endangered species nowadays, but somebody like the mayor of New York, Bloomberg, who's obviously got deep pockets, funding an alternative to the Club for Growth and giving these leaders that lack the profiles and courage to stand up to the more zealous members of their caucus, to give them the financial cover they have to counteract the Koch brothers and others?
I'm all for it. There actually is an effort underway. Steve LaTourette, a former Republican congressman from Ohio who retired and now heads the Mainstream Partnership, which used to be a group of moderate Republicans. Now it's a group of conservative but sane Republicans, is trying to raise money to do that, to protect Republicans who were attacked by the Club for Growth and Heritage Action in primaries. But I think we need something, as Tom suggested, that's bigger and broader and more ambitious and has a much wider imprimatur, and it needs a lot more money. You have to find something that can counter the pernicious impact of money out there. And, of course, we need even more than that. And, you know, one thing I have to say, Ian, is Tom and I have this as a mantra wherever we go. We're often hit because we seem to be criticizing Republicans. We're criticizing Republicans at this point not because we're anti-Republican, but because that's where the criticism belongs. But we know the American system needs two healthy, vigorous parties going at one another. Those parties are not going to be identical ideologically, and we're not going to have a Republican Party that's made up of moderates or liberals. It'll be conservative. The problem now is it's dominated by radicals, not conservatives.
Well, Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann, I thank you both for joining us here today.
Our pleasure, Ian.
Again, thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an election eve analyst for CBS News. He led a working group of scholars and practitioners that helped shape the law known as the McCain-Feingold that reformed the campaign financing system. He was elected as a fellow to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2004. And also joining us was Thomas Mann, a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, where he holds the W. Averill Harriman Chair. A noted congressional scholar, he writes and speaks widely on American politics and policymaking, including campaigns, elections, campaign finance reform, and the effectiveness of Congress. Together, they are the co-authors of The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get Back on Track, and most recently, the New York Times bestseller, now out in paperback, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back with a program from October the 8th, 2013, with Senator Bernie Sanders. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders was elected to the United States Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He's the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. Welcome to Background Briefing, Senator Sanders.
Good to be with you.
And, Senator, you were on the steps of the Supreme Court after having gone into the court to hear the oral arguments in McCutcheon versus the FEC. Let's start with the actual oral arguments. To your mind, who equipped themselves the best? Those on McCutcheon's side, the millionaire who...
Well, to my mind, and this is actually the very first time that I have been to an argument in the Supreme Court, so it was kind of interesting. But to my mind, it really was unworldly in the sense that I'm not quite sure that all of these guys on the Supreme Court have a sense in terms of what happens in the real world politically. In the real world, what we are seeing right now is the devastating impact of big money on the political process, made even worse by Citizens United. And if this this court case goes in favor of big money, it will only make a very, very bad situation a lot worse. What you'll see is the end of limitations in terms of the ability of big money just to even spend more than they currently are.
So given the extent to which Citizens United has already changed the landscape, did you get any sense, Senator Sanders, that any of these conservative justices know what that ruling has wrought?
I'm not sure. Certainly not Scalia. not Alito. Who knows? Maybe maybe the Chief Justice, maybe Roberts, may have some understanding. But I think these guys, in fact, are really separated from what goes on. Right now, let me just give you one example, Ian, which people should know about. As everybody knows, we're in the midst of this horrendous government shutdown. What people don't know is one of the reasons that this has not yet ended is in the House right now, you have House members, the extreme right wing, who are telling other members that if they are prepared to vote for a clean, continuing resolution, they will face a primary and they will face a unlimited amount of money in opposition to them. And that's what Citizens United is all about. So you stand up and you try to do maybe the right thing, in this case, open up the government. And what you're going to be faced with is, you know, people like the Koch brothers and others who have huge amounts of money who are prepared to spend millions to defeat you. This is undermining American democracy, and to give even more ability to big money people to influence the political process is beyond comprehension.
Well, I must say I find it extraordinary, Senator Sanders, that three individuals, David and Charles Koch and Rupert Murdoch, combined, have moved this country so far to the right in the last few decades, it's breathtaking. And the idea that a couple of billionaires with almost unlimited funds can set up this mechanism that terrorizes, in fact, it is a form of terrorism, that terrorizes moderate...
You make a great point, and that is the point, and that's what Citizens United has done. And what we're looking at, and people should understand this, and I've been trying to make this point on the floor of the Senate, is if anybody thinks that this is just about the Affordable Care Act, about Obamacare, and trying to defund that, they would be sorely mistaken. This is part of the extreme right-wing agenda, which essentially wants to repeal every major piece of legislation passed in the last 80 years, which protect the interests of working people, the elderly, the children, the sick, the poor, the environment. That's what they want to do. And the difficulty of these so-called negotiations right now, or the debate right now, is that if you submitted to this blackmail, I will guarantee you 100% that they will be back again and again. And maybe next time they will say, well, you know what? We're going to shut down the government unless you make drastic cuts in Social Security or you privatize it. Or we're going to shut down the government unless you repeal the minimum wage or you do away with the Environmental Protection Agency. They have a right-wing agenda which calls for bringing this country back into the 1920s, moving us to an oligarchic form of society where the people like Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers and a few other billionaires really control the economics and politics of this nation. That is what this whole process is about.
And it would seem that the rubric by which they're operating is the sky is falling over the deficits, and the deficits are just a stalking horse to
absolutely
reduce the taxes on the rich, isn't it?
Yeah. Look, here's what the truth of the matter is that we have reduced the deficit from about $1.4 trillion to $700 billion in the last few years. What is, if you go up to the average person in California, Vermont, or any place else, and you say, what do you see the major domestic problem facing America? What do they say overwhelmingly in every single poll done in the last many years? What they say, it is jobs and the economy. That's what people say. Real unemployment today is not 7.4%. It is close to 14%. Youth unemployment is a lot higher than that. African-American youth unemployment is close to 40%. Wages have gone down for tens of millions of American workers who in many cases are working longer hours for lower pay. What people are saying is we need an economy in which we have decent paying jobs and we have enough jobs so that people are not facing unemployment. That is the issue that people are concerned about. Is the deficit important? Yeah, it is. And we've made some progress in that deficit in the last few years. People want us to focus now on the economy. And when we're caught up in all of this stuff, there is no discussion about how we create millions of jobs, no discussion about how we raise the minimum wage, no discussion about how we make college more affordable. and how we address the real serious issues facing the middle class.
And again, I'm speaking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He's the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history, and today he attended the arguments in McCutcheon versus the FEC at the Supreme Court and later spoke on the steps of the Supreme Court, where you said, Senator Sanders, freedom of speech, in my view, does not mean the freedom to buy the United States government. And what was the response from the people there?
Well, the people that I spoke to who are actively involved in the issue of campaign finance reform obviously agreed. And I think most Americans do. It's, you know, this is one of the interesting issues where you have conservatives, you have progressives, you have moderates, Democrats, Republicans, Independents coming together. You go out on the streets and you say, do you think it's okay for people like the Koch brothers who are worth $70 billion to be able to spend hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars deciding who's going to be the governor of Wisconsin, who's going to be president of the United States, who's going to be in the United States Senate here, what the legislative agenda will be in the United States Congress, and people say, you're nuts. That's absurd. That's crazy. That's not what a democracy is about. And they're right. Nobody believes this makes sense, except the billionaires who want to have more power and whose greed appears to be never-ending.
But, of course, the billionaires, the constituents of these Tea Party Congress people who are both shutting down the government at the moment and threatening to tank the economy, they in many ways support their representatives based upon, in effect, economic illiteracy. One of the arguments out now is that the debt ceiling is not that important. I'm astounded, frankly, that Wall Street hasn't weighed in some more. There's quite a lot of very, very senior analysts on Wall Street who are very complacent, saying, oh, this is never going to happen. The chance of a default is zero. You're there on the Hill. I don't have that sense that these people are bluffing.
Well, I think you may very well be right. We'll find out soon enough. I think what you have is a couple of things. What you're looking at is people should not see this as a debate over Obamacare. This is a huge ideological debate by the extreme right wing who want to repeal virtually every major piece of legislation passed in the last 8 years. So they certainly do not want to see the federal government playing a role in providing health insurance today to people who don't have it. But much more than that, they want to end Medicare as we know it right now, move it into a voucher program. They want to make massive cuts in Medicaid. They don't want Medicaid expanded. They want to make Medicaid decimated. These guys want to end Social Security. Ian, these guys, and they're upfront about it. They're upfront about it. People don't know this. You know, we're having a debate right now in Congress, or at least some of us are supporting legislation to raise the minimum wage because we think we have tens of millions of workers who are making less than $10 an hour, can't raise a family, starvation wages. Do you know what the majority of the Republicans now in Congress believe in terms of the minimum wage? Do you know what they believe?
What?
For them, it is not a question of whether or not you raise the minimum wage. They believe we should abolish the concept of the minimum wage. So that in a high unemployment area in the United States, say Detroit, or some other high unemployment area, if somebody was desperate enough to have to work for $3 or $4 an hour, our right-wing friends see that as freedom because we've gotten the government out of the business of putting a floor on wages, that an employer can hire an employee for any wage that both of them agree to. Isn't that just what freedom is all about? And if in America people are working for $3, $4 an hour, isn't that great? That's what these guys believe. That's true. I mean, and this is what many, many members, Republican members of the United States Congress believe. That's their understanding of freedom. So what people have got to appreciate is this stuff is a lot more than Obamacare. What this stuff is an extremist right-wing agenda funded by people like the Koch brothers and others who want to really create an America in their vision. Which is really an oligarchic type of society where a few people on top have unbelievable control over the political process and the economy as well.
And that's where we're heading if we're not already there. I mean, that, how do you get – I understand the motives of the Koch brothers. They don't want a government. They don't want anybody telling them what to do. But why would American people think that total laissez-faire economy run by oligarchs would in any way benefit them? That's the part that I find –
that's a good question, worthy of a longer discussion than we have time for now. But, you know, it has to do with, among other things, the lack of a strong labor movement in America, which is clearly being targeted by these very same people. It has to do with a corporately owned media, so that if you live in many states in this country where you have right-wing political leadership, you're never going to hear a progressive point of view. You're never going to learn that the United States, for example, is the only country in the industrialized world that doesn't guarantee health care to all people as a right. How many people in America even know that? You know, the idea right now, Obamacare, you know, which is, in my view, kind of a moderate Republican-type approach, which expands health insurance to 20, 25 million Americans, still leaving 25 million without health insurance, by the way. We are behind, you know, with Obamacare, we're still behind every other major country. How many American people even know that? How many people know that we spend twice as much per person on health care as do the people of any other major country with worse health outcomes in many respects? You know, so we are a country where political consciousness is not terribly high, and that's a combination of a very effective work done by the right wing, a corporately controlled media, a weak labor movement, and a Democratic Party, which is certainly not doing the kinds of things it needs to be doing in standing up for working people and putting the Republicans on the defensive. I mean, in that regard, one of the things that I am fighting for here is to see if we can change the rules here in the Senate so we don't need 60 votes for at least a few month period and push through some serious legislation which creates jobs, which raises wages, which really deals with the crisis of college affordability, which deals with equal pay for equal rights, which deals, in fact, moving toward a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. So the American people have got to see that there is some action by some people that is trying to defend their interests. And I'm afraid in many cases they don't, and they don't pay attention, and the Koch brothers and those guys can just keep going.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Senator Sanderson, for fighting the good fight. And hopefully people listening to us will recognize that they have to join this fight before they lose their country.
That's exactly correct. Ian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders was elected to the United States Senate in 2006 after serving 60 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history, and today he attended the oral arguments in the Supreme Court in the case of McCutcheon versus the FEC and later spoke on the steps of the Supreme Court. This has been a retrospective of Background Briefing broadcast from 2013. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.